This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Religious and civic leaders have long advocated forgiveness as a virtue, something we ought to do because it's inherently good. Now research suggests that forgiveness is also good for you, that it can reduce the risk of heart attacks, slow the spread of cancer, and retard HIV's development into full-blown AIDS, all of which seems intuitive, but which raises some interesting questions. If forgiveness is good for you, is it still altruism? When there's an especially terrible crime, isn't forgiveness awfully hard to find sometimes? And then maybe the trickiest question of them all, how do you go about forgiving yourself? Later in the hour, another installment of our Next Big Thing series. We'll talk with Murray Horowitz about what to watch for in the movies and the movie business in 2008. Here's a hint. You have to wear nerdy glasses to see it right. But first, forgiveness. If you've forgiven someone who did you wrong, how did it change you? Or if there's someone you simply can't forgive, how does that affect you? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Melissa Healy of the Los Angeles Times wrote an article about forgiving the unforgivable and joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation. Happy
New Year. It's a pleasure to be here.
Forgiveness is a concept I guess we're mostly familiar with in a religious context.
It is, and I think for many, many millennia, forgiveness is one of those things that seems to have been found to be very good for nations, very good for communities. But over the last 10 years or so, researchers have been keen to show that it's also good for individuals to forgive each other.
What's the genesis of this new research?
Well, there are a couple of foundations that have been very faith-minded, that they have sought to apply some rigor to a number of notions that have religious bases. And, of course, like anything of this sort, when matters of virtue are put to a test of rigor, the results are invariably controversial.
For example, what are some of the results?
Well, some of the results, some of the findings have been that those who are more inclined to forgive have lower blood pressure. They're less inclined toward depression. They have better overall mental and physical health, in particular as they age. That the act of forgiving itself, in some cases, appears to improve cardiovascular function, that it diminishes chronic pain in some cases, and that it can improve the quality of life for the very ill. But what's not known and what the research really hasn't answered yet is whether it is forgiving people who are healthier or whether forgiving makes them healthier.
That's an interesting distinction, and I guess that hasn't been answered yet. We'll talk with one of the researchers in a bit. There are also questions that you raise in your article about whether, well, forgiveness can be very, very difficult.
It is indeed.
When you talk to people who have had experience with, being molested as a child, that sort of thing, or HIV patients who have a difficult time forgiving the person they think infected them.
Mm-hmm. Well, look to your right, look to your left. There is none of us who doesn't deal with forgiveness on small and large levels every day. And some of us find it difficult to move beyond the person who cuts you off in traffic, hence the road rage. Others of us cannot get beyond the parent who abused or the boss who's a jerk.
Does it make a difference, at least according to the research that's been done, as to whether the person who's been forgiven accepts it?
No. In fact, one of the key controversial facts about the nature of the research going on is that by definition, the requirement of true forgiveness by their definition frequently requires that the person who has trespassed against us is in no way penitent. That instead you merely, as a, if you will, virtually a gift to yourself and to that person, that you not only move on, not only drop the anger and recrimination, but that you give the gift of empathy and goodwill toward that person. And that has been terribly controversial.
Now, is it Does forgiveness have to be separated from religious concepts in order to be studied objectively? You would think it would.
Well, there is always the question of definition. Take, for instance, the simple fact of the simple question, does the trespasser need to want forgiveness? If that's not part of the study design, well, then we haven't really answered the question of whether true forgiveness is taking place, whether the individual, for instance, the motivations of the individual who forgives, doesn't matter whether you forgive out of sheer self-interest or if you forgive because it's a teaching of your church or whatever.
Well, to tell us more about how people learn to forgive and how researchers study forgiveness, we're joined now by Fred Luskin, director of the Stanford University's Forgiveness Projects. He researches forgiveness, and he's written a new book called Forgive for Love, and he joins us from his home near Stanford University. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And you can teach people to forgive?
I've been doing it for more than a decade, pretty successfully, yep.
And how do you do that?
Well, partly what I think Melissa was just saying is you understand that it doesn't matter what the motivation is, but you take the training and teach it as just simply a skill. You want to learn a bicycle, you do these things. You want to forgive, you do these things. The simplest strategies involve stress management for the negative, resentful feelings, changing the way you tell the story about what happened, and doing some very simple cognitive strategies to, at some level, take the person out of feeling like they're the center of the universe.
Stop the why me so much.
I'm sorry?
Stop the why me.
Why me, why me, why not me, how dare they, what were they thinking, and when you explore stuff, you realize that most people who hurt other people weren't thinking about the people they hurt at all.
How do you study the health effects of forgiveness?
You know, it's the interesting thing is that the question is being asked is this is kind of weird, and we can study the health effects of anything. So if you wanted to give people, say, a picture of Bozo the Clown and see how, you know, what that did, you could hook them up to EKGs and EEGs and test the level of tension in their muscles, or have them spit into a cup and see what kind of stress chemicals there are.
But this research is not being paid for by the Bozo the Clown Foundation.
No, the research is hard to come by, is one of the difficulties in this field. But what we started to do in the last 15 years is say, okay, all of the scriptures and all of the ethics say that forgiveness is a good idea. Now let's prove it.
So you set out to prove it.
That was my intention. I mean, not me alone. And from a personal point of view, I set out to prove it because of my own very deep wounding and what it took for me to get to a place of forgiveness about that.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I had a very, very, very close friendship that was ripped apart and with no explanation or nothing that I could think of as that I did. And I was absolutely bereft and almost crazed from this, the sheer dissipation of it almost instantly, and suffered for a long time. Only when I realized that I have to forgive did my life turn around about it.
I wonder, is your research funded by these two foundations, these two institutions that Melissa Healy was talking about, the Michigan-based Fetzer Foundation and the John Templeton Foundation of Pennsylvania?
The Templeton Foundation founded my biggest research project, and I'm actually one of the national spokespeople on forgiveness for the Fetzer Institute. I'm one of the two other people at this point who are nationally out there trying to say, please do this.
And we know you're also a respected scientist and would not publish anything that you couldn't validate scientifically, but the foundations fund research into some questions and not necessarily into others.
That's the nature of science.
And the nature of foundations with an agenda.
and you put the two of them together and it's total chaos, but yes.
Okay. And do you find, do you wish that there were more research available for a broader inquiry into this?
Let me put it into some perspective that I do outcome studies, which are if you take people at equal periods of time and you give some of them a forgiveness intervention and you give some of them something else or nothing, a year later, 6 months later, 6 weeks later, are they in a different place? Any of the people who have done forgiveness outcome studies have found them to be helpful. They are helpful in all sorts of ways. Most of the established ways are about emotional conditions, such as we have shown that they it reduces stress and anger and depression and self-pity and increases confidence and optimism and hope and compassion. And there have been a few that show that it has a direct link to physical health. But the great majority of them, there aren't a huge number of outcome studies, they all show positive value.
And Melissa Healy, that seems to accord with what you found in your story.
Well, mental health, obviously, the links between mental and physical health have become stronger and stronger with more research. Certainly depression and other mental health issues can be risk factors for a host of diseases, including cardiovascular disease. And to the extent that you can reduce stress and anger, you would presume that better health, better physical health would be the result.
We're talking about forgiveness and health this hour. There are some questions we have not yet addressed, and we'll try to get to those and to your calls. 800-989-8255 is the number. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can check out what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we'll be hearing from a psychotherapist who warns you against forgiving too quickly. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here's an email we got from Gail in Anchorage, Alaska. I have two sisters who have never been able to forgive our dad for past deeds. They both have severe heart problems the rest of us do not have. We're talking today about forgiveness and health, new research, and unanswered questions. Our guests are Melissa Healy. She's a writer with the Los Angeles Times, and Fred Luskin, director of the Stanford University's Forgiveness Projects. If you've forgiven someone who did you wrong, how did it change you? If there's someone you simply can't forgive, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get a caller on the line. And this is Rick. Rick with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi there.
Hi, Rick.
I love your show and listen to you daily.
Well, thank you for that.
And I've experienced both periods of time where I think I've experienced true forgiveness and also periods of time where I've had trouble letting go of resentment. And first, I just want to comment on the relationship to that and my health seems perfectly correlated. And I agree with everything I've heard on the show today. I just want to comment on one aspect that I haven't heard discussed and doesn't apply to all situations, but I think as in a general rule can be very helpful, and that is the process of focusing on one's own ethics and integrity and how critical looking within and leading a rigorous, honest life plays in forgiving others.
Hmm. Fred Luskin, is that part of your process?
In some ways it is, because one of the chief things that one learns is you have limited influence on people who have hurt you and may not like you, and much more influence on yourself. And what we try to tell people all the time is look more about your character than theirs, which is if you can say that they had bad character because they lied to you or cheated you, that may be true, but there's nothing you can do about it. When you look at your own character, you have to ask yourself, what kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to take your wounds and become like a nasty, bitter person? Or do you want to take your wounds and become something else with it? And that is a central question that often people, before they come into the work that I do, don't ask themselves.
Does that sound reasonable to you, Rick?
Absolutely.
All right. And you, as a process, as part of this process, do you feel better?
Me, myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
I mean, it goes in cycles, of course, and it's an ever-learning process, but the more that I'm focused, and this is kind of a paradox, but the more that I'm focused outside myself, like I heard your guest mention, getting away from the self-centered universe aspect, so the more I'm focused on service work and helping others and my own integrity, the more peace and happy I feel about myself and the better my health becomes.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, and have a happy New Year.
Neil, can I say one thing?
Go ahead, please, Dr. Fred Luskin.
What that gentleman just said is so central to why I teach this and why I think Melissa wrote about it, that forgiveness, which had been limited to the religious traditions, is a remarkable process that helps people. And, you know, it's wonderful to say that it does help people's health, which it does, and it does improve their character. But it's really a multidimensional help. And, you know, I agree to be interviewed by people like Melissa because I just think the word needs to get out that there is this good science that shows that this is this, like, turning the other cheek kind of thing has powerful benefit.
Here's an email we got from Sue in Panama City. Forgiveness, not harboring resentment, is the cornerstone of the 12-step program used by Alcoholics Anonymous, etc. Truth and reconciliation in countries as in South Africa have done a world of good, but lawyers in the United States, with their creed of never admit to anything, have so undermined our sense of accepting responsibility and sue anyone, especially a corporation with deep pockets, that harms you, accidentally or not. I just wonder, Fred Luskin, do you think we live in an environment which encourages the harboring of grudges?
I'll respond to that by just asking you and your other guest and anybody in your audience to consider, do you spend more time with your friends complaining about people, about what they did wrong, even the people you love, or praising them? And most of us have a tremendous habit of, like, calling other people up to say, this is what my lover did, this is what my friend did, this is what my mother did wrong. That's unforgiveness. We are so much less schooled in acknowledging the gifts that come to us, the kindnesses, the loyalty. So it's so foundational in our culture to look for what's wrong that, of course, a legal system is going to emerge out of that. But if even in our marriages we took the time, even with a person that we're in difficulty with, to just catalog, yeah, this is what they did, this is what they didn't do, this is how they've tried to love me, this is how they haven't, we'd at least have a place where a different kind of negotiation would occur. And that can be taken on the micro of a couple and the macro of nations, fighting each other. I mean, it's an essential human question.
Fred Luskin, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Oh, that's it. Thank you very much.
Frederick Luskin, director of Stanford University's Forgiveness Projects, and he joined us from his home in San Jose, California. Jeannie Safer joins us now. She's a New York-based psychotherapist who warns that choosing not to forgive may also have health benefits. She's written a book called Forgiving and Not Forgiving, Why Sometimes It's Better Not to Forgive. She joins us from NPR's Bureau in New York. And Happy New Year. Nice of you to be with us today.
I'm delighted to be here as the voice of the loyal opposition.
Okay. Well, we've heard about all the wonderful health benefits of forgiveness. What's so bad about it?
Well, there's nothing bad about it. It's just there's not one-size-fits-all solution to these kinds of problems. You know, Dr. Luskin was talking about how a friend betrayed him and how forgiveness freed him. Well, interestingly enough, I had exactly the same experience. And I thought not just about myself, I thought about what my friend did and why she did it very deeply, and I concluded that it was not necessary to forgive her, just not to hate her. And I can tell you that I feel quite free and very happy about where I am with it. And I did not go that route, nor do many of my patients. In fact, many people feel that there is too much emphasis on forgiveness, that if they don't do it, there's something wrong with them. And so they get a double whammy. First, something terrible happens to them, and then they feel guilty that they can't fix it by forgiving and loving.
Yeah, in Melissa Healy's article, you're quoted as talking about a forgiveness lobby.
Yes, I think we just heard from him. And
I
want to make it very clear that I'm not against forgiveness. I'm against compulsory forgiveness. I'm struck by the fact that we have no word for healthy unforgiveness. No, that all we have is either forgiveness or hatred and vengeance. How about coming to a point where it's not so important? How about not having to cross the street when the person comes towards you? Isn't that enough for most people? And isn't that okay?
You also talk about if there's pressure on people to forgive, some of that inevitably is not going to be totally sincere.
Well, there's no question of that. Anything that's so quick as an immediate forgiveness can't be true, because forgiveness, or what I call healthy resolution, which is the alternative, really takes time and effort, and it always takes looking inward. And also, again, not to contrary to what Dr. Wilskin said, it takes really understanding the motivation of the other, in my opinion, and whether you feel that the person does deserve your forgiveness, whether they're alive or dead. I think it's that this is a process that doesn't have one predetermined outcome.
Neil, one of the
Go ahead, Melissa.
One of the interesting events that I wrote about was the nickel mine shooting, which took place in Amish country about a year ago, in which a large group of Amish children were very, very violently murdered. And the immediate reaction of the Amish community, deeply religious, was forgiveness. And it was a source of a tremendous admiration to many. And on the part of many of the researchers I talked to and a number of the therapists I talked to, a subject of greeted with great skepticism. How, they asked, could you so quickly forgive? Where was the anger? Where was the grief? Where were, you know, how it should have taken more time, more grief.
Let's get a caller in on this. This is Karen. Karen calling us from Chelsea in Michigan.
Hi, this is Karen.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I was molested by my stepfather for about 6 years when I was 7 years old. And after the birth of my children, my anger increased looking upon how could somebody do that to me as a child now that I have children of my own. And it sent me into therapy. And one day my therapist asked me, you know, if I liked myself. And it kind of threw me back, and I realized it was sort of an epiphany moment that, yes, I actually like myself, and at that moment, I chose to forgive my stepfather for that continued act that he did to me, largely for myself, as the doctor was saying before. It was for me. I needed to accept what had happened to me as a part of me recognizing that I had worth now, and that was an epiphany moment for me. I have not yet even told my stepfather nor my mother, who is still married to him, of my forgiveness, because it is very personal to me.
Have you talked to them about the crime?
Oh, yes, they know. We've had family counseling and therapy for many years afterwards. I had held it until I was in college, and then I finally did tell my mother my freshman year of college about what had happened to me, and she signed us up for some family counseling.
And did your stepfather did your stepfather admit to this?
Yes, he has admitted to it.
Yeah. That makes a big difference. When the person acknowledges, it is easier to forgive. But many people who have had incest really feel stronger that they don't have to forgive. And that's also sometimes a way to have self-worth. It's not forgiveness. Your forgiveness was very natural because you came to it, it sounds like, on your own. You weren't kind of lobbied that you had to do it in advance.
Exactly.
And sometimes that's a good, natural way to do it. But I've had many patients who had terrible things happen to them and felt stronger and liked themselves better when they felt like they didn't have to forgive.
Exactly. And when I was actually encouraged or basically told that it was time to forget over this, basically.
Right. I bet you didn't like that.
No, that didn't work so well.
Right.
If it comes from kids, like I said, I actually went the other way.
But you did it naturally. It came from within, and that's when it really works. You know, saying that we have to teach people to do it, I think, isn't the way to have it really happen.
Right.
Thanks. Your way works.
Congratulations, Karen.
Thank you very much.
And thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're talking about forgiveness and health, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Melissa, there's another item that comes up in your article, and that is sometimes, and we're certainly not talking about Karen's case, but sometimes people, for example, who've been abused as children, they may forgive the perpetrator and then turn the blame in on themselves.
Well, this really brings us back to the question of the motivations for forgiveness. There are a group of people. They are not the hard-charging type A personalities that we know about that are given to cardiovascular problems. They're not the easygoing type Bs. They are a group that are widely referred to as type Cs, and they tend to blame themselves for things. They tend not really to express their anger. In fact, they don't want to feel anger, and they tend to be very rapid forgivers, very readily forgiving people, particularly when they're prompted by clergymen, prompted by brothers and sisters who'd like to keep the peace. And the problem is that they continue to carry that baggage around in spite of the fact that all seems well, and the damage may be to themselves.
Jeannie Safer, I wanted to ask you about this.
Yes.
We've been obviously talking about the health benefits of forgiveness. Obviously, if you turn the blame on yourself, that can't be healthy.
No, indeed. In fact, I would suggest a control group to all of the studies that the Templeton Foundation has researched. And that is a group of people who felt that they had to forgive and felt terrible about themselves because of it, and give them some talks about healthy unforgiveness and measure their blood pressure. Let's see. Now, there's no foundation that's going to do that research. But I think it would be very, very helpful for us that we make this. We fail to make a distinction between anger and hatred. And anger, why is anger so terrible? We all feel angry about all kinds of things, and one of my patients said even God gets angry. Why must we always get rid of anger? Why not just hope to through understanding, help it go in the background?
I think God gets wrathful, and
I'm
sure that's quite the same thing.
That's right. That's right.
And anyway, here's an email question from Dennis. Does forgiveness also mean trust? I may excuse someone for a misdeed, but I may never trust them again. Is that one of the distinctions you're talking about?
Absolutely. That love and trust cannot necessarily be created by will. We can hope that we can reengage, we can cultivate receptivity, but we can't make ourselves forgive any more than we can make ourselves love someone again. Sometimes love is destroyed, and all we can get to is a neutrality that doesn't destroy us. And I think that's good enough.
Just wanted to let you address the question of unasked questions. Again, the research largely funded by two foundations hoping to get positive answers to questions. And what are the unasked questions, Melissa Healy?
I thought one of the most intriguing notions that I came across was the notion that in the final analysis, forgiveness of self might be, from a health point of view, one of the most important, one of the most powerful things here. And what's interesting about that is that it would so depart from the any religious basis. I mean, forgiving oneself, forgive thyself is not a commandment.
Yeah.
And to the extent that forgiving yourself, something which is hard to do, but clearly, almost certainly important for one's health, to the extent that future researchers will look into that, I think that would be very interesting.
Here's an email we have from Kelly. Forgiveness for me is twofold. Both are equally difficult. I was sexually abused by my older brother from the time I was 10 or 12 until 12 or 13. He has since died. For years, I've suffered from many self-destructive behaviors, including cutting, so I have great trouble forgiving him, but even more forgiving myself for what I've done for myself. And I guess, Jeannie Safer, that's what you were talking about.
I think forgiving yourself is the only essential type of forgiveness, because that's the one person you can't cut out of your life.
Jeannie Safer, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Jeannie Safer is a psychotherapist in New York and wrote the book Forgiving and Not Forgetting, Why Sometimes It's Better Not to Forgive. She joined us from NPR's Bureau in New York. And our thanks as well to Melissa Healy, a writer for the Los Angeles Times, who joined us to discuss her article on forgiveness here in Studio 3A. And again, thank you for your time today and Happy New Year.
It's been my pleasure.
When we come back, it's our week-long series on the next big thing. We've got Murray Horowitz right here in Studio 3A, or 3D, is it? Which is, as he'll tell you, pretty trendy. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.